Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well.
I absolutely love this because, you know, if you own a home, it can be really hard to maintain. It's hard to find people that can help you for a big project or a small. Well, whether it's in everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality, it can be hard just to know where to start. But now all you need to do is Angie that. And find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish. Or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps, because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
Alexa, who is Adam Ferrara?
Adam Ferrara is an American actor and comedian known for playing the roles of Chief Needles Nelson on Rescue Me, Sergeant Frank Fiorelli opposite Edie Falco on Nurse Jackie. He was a co-host on the U.S. version of Top Gear. He has had 3 Comedy Central specials and his new album is called It's Scary in Here. Adam's new podcast is a big hit and available everywhere.
Sounds like it could be funny.
Sounds to me like 30 minutes you'll never get back.
Hi guys, thank you for coming back or checking us out for the first time. Either way, we're glad you're here. We have a great show for you again this week. My guest in the ADD interview, you know him from Weeds, you know him from Saturday Night Live, you know him from Man with a Plan. It is Kevin Nealand. And we want to welcome everyone from our Talk to Me Tuesday family, which is our conversation we have every week, 9 o'clock Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Go to my website, click the link, and join us. And our superfan shout-out is for Robert. Say hi to Robert, guys.
Hey, Robert.
Hey, Bobby.
What's up, Bobby?
You hear those voices, Robert, do you? Not the ones in your head, the ones coming out of your phone. Those are the people I love. My beautiful wife, Alex.
Hello there.
My lifelong friend, Phil Tagg.
What's up, buddy?
And my pal, my pod producer, a man who has learned the importance of oral hygiene.
Yes, I have.
Triple P himself, Marcus Stern. How are you, my friend?
I'm good. And my teeth are relatively healthy, so I feel good about that.
Well, you have to go back. Let's catch the audience up. Mark, you rinse, and I'll let them know what's going on. So Mark gets out of the U.S. Open. He calls me up the other day. I'm like, what's the matter? Root canal. What? I'm going to go back for the root canal. Oh, okay. So you got to go back for the root canal.
Well, yeah. So I had a root canal. All right. Backing up. I didn't go to a dentist for like 30 years because every time I went, it was pain and suffering. So when I got to be an adult, I was like, yeah, I'm not doing this anymore. All right. I'm just going to try and do the best I can. Went a long time, had a pain in my tooth about 6 years ago. Doc said, hey, you got to go get a root canal. And I was terrified because a root canal just sounds like the worst thing in the world. So I go, this is lovely oral surgeon. Her name is Dr. Anastasia Mashenko. She might be a Russian spy. I have no idea. If I have nuclear codes on me, I'm sure I'm going to give them to her. Mm-hmm. The best root canal anyone could ever hope for. It was like completely painless. And I go back every year to make sure that it's not, you know, messed up or anything like that. And sure enough, after the U.S. Open, she was like, yeah, we got to go in and we got to fix some stuff. So I got to do that in a couple of days.
The most frightening thing about that is not that you have a potential spy working on your mouth. The most frightening thing about that was I haven't been to a dentist in 30 years.
I got to a point in my life. I was like, yeah, I don't want to go do that.
Okay, see, there's the problem. There's the problem, Stern. No one goes to the dentist because they want to. You go to the friggin' dentist because you have to.
All right. Well, who looks like the idiot now? When I finally saw the dentist after, I don't know, 25, 30 years, he was like, your teeth are in remarkably great shape. Like, they're fine. He's like, you've been brushing, you've been taking care, you have no cavities, all your fillings are good. You just got this, you know, one tooth that's got a root canal thing, and we'll take care of that.
Mm-hmm. Adam, if you think about it, that's pretty good odds.
Yeah, but the guy he said the dentist he went to is probably, what is he, blind?
Just in one eye.
Yeah.
You figure 30 in 30 years, one bad tooth. That's pretty good.
Okay. Yeah, that's pretty good. So the moral of the story is don't go to the dentist.
Thank you.
That's good. That's good. That's a positive message. That's good.
Listen to Uncle Mark, kids.
Yeah. Should she take an x-ray and then go into the other room? I hate when they do that.
No, they take an x-ray and it's like right there. It downloads on the computer immediately. It's 3D stuff. It's crazy technology they have. Wow. And I remember when I had the surgery, they had a Norah Jones live concert playing on the TV. I was like, this is lovely. I can stay here forever.
So now he can't stop going.
Right. I'm like, yeah, I'd love to go. So this is sort of, I have to go. But in my mind, I'm like, I get to go because I also feel good that I'm taking care of it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, mm-hmm. After 30 years.
Now, right. Now, I was a sinner, and now I'm, you know, I'm reborn.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So the dentist is like a baptism for you.
Exactly.
That's what that's really what the little sink is for. Mm-hmm. But yeah, getting back to what you said, you have to go. So mm-hmm. That's the difference between have to and want to. And that's the mindset. I was actually talking to Kevin about this in the interview because there's a weird thing in my head about when I got to do something new. Uncertainty in my head breeds anxiety if I don't know what I'm doing. So there's that kind of thing just triggers my anxiety. So mm-hmm. In order to get past that, I'm working on shifting my head from have to want to.
Mm-hmm. Adam, I can relate, but what's hard for me and I know you know this about me, so don't give away too much. But
All right, let me just preface this because I think I know what you're going to say. Let me just preface this. My wife is smoking hot. Okay, go ahead.
But you know if I have to do something, what happens? It off.
Yes, if you have to do something, yeah, my wife, she'll put it off. Like, honey, your head's on fire. It's going to rain tomorrow. It's fine.
I do. And I really want to change that because I know once I do it, it's like, oh, this was so easy. Why did I wait so long? Or, I wish I would have done this sooner. And it always happens.
Yeah. Well, it's building it up in your head. That's the worst place to live is in your own head. And because I realized how crazy I'm making. You think I make you guys crazy. Imagine what I'm doing to me.
Yeah. I love your new album cover. It suits you really well.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Oh, by the way, and I want to thank everybody in podcast land about the new album. You know why?
Why, Adam?
It's number one on iTunes.
And
it's all because of you guys. So thank you guys very much. And you know what? It's like that album, like, oh, I have to get this done. I have to get this done. I have to get this done. But then when I put it together, I'm like, I'm so glad I did this. The difference between framing something in your head between have to and want to is very important because it sets up how you're going to experience that thing. It's not like it's unknown. I mean, I did one last year. I've done a bunch of specials. So it's the throes of creation. But what Kevin does is he embraces the unknown. I mean, I really admire that about him. He does so many things as far as creative endeavors that was one of the things that I really admired about him is he just throwing himself into something new without any or appearing without any anxiety at all. His enthusiasm, his curiosity, and his passion for life and learning new things. So I was really struck by it. And I think you guys are going to get a lot out of this. So give a listen to this and we'll see you on the other side.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well.
I absolutely love this because, you know, if you own a home, it can be really hard to maintain. It's hard to find people that can help you for a big project or a small. Well, whether it's in everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality, it can be hard just to know where to start. But now all you need to do is Angie that. And find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish. Or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
Well, now, Triple P, you will tell me what I want to know.
You're listening to the Adam Ferrara Podcast. This is 30 minutes you'll never get back.
I'm up to here with this crap.
Hi, guys. I am heading back out on the road to do stand-up. Did you hear that? That was Alex saying, thank God. I will be at Bananas in Hasbrook Heights, New Jersey, October 16th and 17th. I will be at Comics at the Mohegan Sun Casino, October 22nd through the 24th. And October 30th, I will be at Soul Joel's Amphitheater in Royers Ford, Pennsylvania. I don't know if I said that right, but that's where I'm going to be. I'll put a link to tickets right here in the show notes, or you can go to my website and click the ticket link there. If you can make any of these gigs, please come up and say hello after the show. I would like to thank you for all the love and support you've shown me and this podcast. And I'll stay 6 feet away from you because I know where I've been. I'm doing this for you.
Pay attention when I'm talking to you, boy.
ADHD, it's not just for kids.
Nice boy, but doesn't listen to a word you say.
Welcome to the ADD interview. It's not that you're not interesting, it's just that I can't focus. And my guest this week is...
Oh, look, a bird!
If you've ever watched television, you know my guest. He's a veteran of Saturday Night Live. He starred in the long-running Showtime series Weeds, as well as the CBS series Man with a Plan. You can see his show Hiking with Kevin on YouTube. He's a great stand-up comic, a musician, an extremely talented painter, fairly decent department store Santa Claus, and a so-so minister. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, help me welcome Kevin Nealon. How are you, pal?
Good, buddy. It's good seeing you, Adam. It's been a while. I haven't seen you around. I haven't seen anybody around.
I know. Well, the last time, you remember when human beings were freely allowed to move about the country, I saw you on an airplane editing while you were flying.
That's right. It was probably one of those hikes I did.
Yeah. It was funny. You showed me. I'm going to say it was Lily Tomlin, but it was very, very funny.
Yeah. I mean, when I started doing these hikes, I just had my cell phone on the end of a selfie stick, mm-hmm. and I would edit it on iMovie.
Yeah.
And that was like the first year. It was really shaky and stuff. And then some guy sent me this really cool rig that had a GoPro on the end of it. It was carbon graphite selfie stick. Mm-hmm. And then it had an external mic with like a dead cat on, you know, the dead cat that goes over the mic to keep the wind from hitting it.
Yeah.
And then I started learning how to fly a drone. And then I started learning how to edit on Premiere Pro. So it's like a full-time operation now.
Yeah. You do all that stuff. You have you don't have a fear of learning, because in all the stuff I was reading about you, you do many things. You throw yourself into those things. One question I want to ask before we get off the hiking, because it is you and a guest, and you go on a hike, and it's really funny. And people, it's a relaxed setting, so you get to see another side of people that you know from television. Anyone have to pee?
Oh, yeah, always. Helen Hunt is a peer.
Right.
she has no qualms about going off the trail, because I hike with her every once in a while too. Besides that, you know, we're hiking buddies, and mm-hmm. she will always mark her territory.
Okay.
You know, let's see, Chelsea Handler.
Yeah.
I think peed. I think that's about it. Most people come prepared.
Okay. One of the things I do in my research on you, I found, is that you educate yourself on so many different things. And you don't seem to be afraid of learning something new. Like, you're a minister. Threw yourself into that.
Well, I'm a minister in the open ministry, because mm-hmm. I did a segment for the Ellen Show once where I had to marry somebody in the Little White Wedding Chapel in Vegas.
Right.
So they went online, and for $50, they made me a minister.
Okay. So maybe that's a bad example.
But since then, I have used that. I married a friend of mine, Kirk Fox, mm-hmm. and he's another comic. And then I also did a vowel renewal for another couple.
I'm sorry. A bowel removal?
A bowel, yeah. It's a bowel removal. No, it's a vowel renewal.
Oh, okay. Thank
a vow.
You.
A vow a renewal. Vow.
Thank you. Yeah, the L was thrown. I just thought a couple that was fighting came to you and go, Kevin, I'm sick of his shit. Don't worry. I'll handle it. I always wanted to ask you this, Minister, because I know we're both Beatles fans. Have you met any of them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I you know, I was on SNL when Paul McCartney came on. Mm-hmm. So I got to know Paul because we were both into animal rights. Mm-hmm. And then I saw him again at the 40th anniversary for SNL.
Right.
And I was sitting in the front row. I was about to go on and do something. And he was in line in front of Paul Simon. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of looking down, kind of going over my notes. They're about to go on the main stage to do something. And all of a sudden, I feel a tap on my shoulder. I look up. It's McCartney. Says, how you doing? I said, hey, Paul, how you doing? And then 2 seconds later, another tap. It's Paul Simon. How you doing? He had an English accent.
That's great.
I was so flattered that they remembered me, you know?
Yeah. How do you not be? That's amazing. Did you flip out?
Yeah. Yeah. I did. And my wife was really impressed.
Oh, yeah. That's got to bring you points right there.
Oh, yeah. 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 But yeah, that was really cool. So, you know, and then I almost met George. I left just before he came up into the writer's wing and he mm-hmm. played the piano for a little bit. And then Al Franken came out. He didn't know who was out there. He goes, can you keep it quiet? I'm trying to write. And it was George Harrison.
So you're a Beatles fan too?
I'm a Beatles fan. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, all those bands. I grew up really, you know, when I first started listening to music, Adam, I listened to, you know, I was more of an Elvis Presley fan.
Right.
You know. But, yeah, so I was more of an Elvis fan. But then I became more of a Beatles fan, you know, and like when I used to live in Germany when I was a kid because my father worked for the helicopter company over there. And so, you know, everything came out around then. You know, Elvis was big then and this is like around 63. I mean, I've been around. I've seen a lot of things. You know, I never saw Elvis in concert, but I saw John F. Kennedy at an airport in Germany in the back of his black limo, Lincoln.
Wow.
Waved to him. I think he waved back to me. Yeah. So I kind of really became a big Beatles fan when I got back to the U.S. And then I started in garage bands. Were you in garage bands?
I was. Yeah. I could play the beginning of every great song. We had like.
I know. Me too.
Yeah. I could do that.
I don't know the lyrics to like many songs. Like during this time now when we're home, I'm starting to learn the rest of the songs that I knew.
Well, that's the thing I wanted to ask you about because you do so many things and you're not afraid to learn new things. Like I know you played the guitar and do my research on you. And you played a 5-string banjo and you picked up the mandolin and the piano. There's different disciplines.
The mandolin, the piano, and just recently I got back from Nashville. Yesterday I got back and brought my ukulele with me. So I've been learning the ukulele, you know, because there's some great, you know, Train has a great song that they play in the ukulele.
Yep.
Jason Mraz, you know, Eddie Vedder from Pearl Jam. It's a really kind of a hip instrument.
Yeah. And you also painted one of my favorite paintings of yours is, and if you have, I highly recommend go on your Instagram because your paintings, that's where I first saw them. And I went, wow, they're caricatures, but there's a depth and a humor to them. And your brushwork is pretty intricate. And one of my favorite ones was Eddie Vedder. And the hair you did on Whitney Houston, that's not easy. That light, the dispersion of light. It's almost like when Rembrandt used to do lace, the lace collars, you could see the light and the depth of that. I was like, wow, he's not fucking around, this kid.
Yeah, I mean, I look for that when I look for a reference piece. I look for the lighting because I think that's really important to give it a good kind of a pop effect, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's more of an interesting look to it. And sometimes I have to, like, you know, I'll go on Pinterest and I'll find 5 or 6 different photos, like I did with Eddie Vedder, and then I have to combine them all in my head and try to get it just, you know, the light right and all the different, you know, features. And that's sometimes a little challenging.
Yeah. And it was, like I said, the hair was very intricate. And there was a, I like Vermeer because the lights on the Vermeer are just, you know, stunning.
Yeah.
You know, it's a whole nother dimension that he opens it up. He brings dignity to the mundane. If you ever look at him, I saw it at the National Gallery. I was like, look at this. She's pouring milk and it's fucking amazing.
I know it. I'm reading a book right now on Leonardo da Vinci by Walter Isaacson.
Yeah. Don't tell me how it ends.
You're not going to be happy. You're not going to be happy.
Dig a tunnel but so we can visit.
It's so interesting, though, man. This guy was such a genius, but he rarely finished things. You know, he'd start off projects or paintings, and he'd get distracted, and he just wouldn't finish it. He'd get commissioned to do things, and he'd have to give the money back because he wouldn't finish it.
Yeah. Did you get to the point about the boyfriend's a kleptomaniac?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. He wasn't really a great boyfriend to bring around to parties and stuff.
No, not with the Medici.
No, I could picture Leonardo da Vinci kind of making excuses for him. You know, he's a younger boy.
He's a young boy.
He's a learning.
Yeah, we'll put the silverware back. Or we're sorry, Your Highness. Get the phone. I'm not here.
That's my brother. Oh. I have two brothers and two sisters. One brother is an ex-Atlanta cop,
mm-hmm.
and now he's a private eye. I have another brother that lives in Florida that makes commercials.
Uh-huh.
You know, he's a producer. And then two sisters.
Catholic family.
Mormons.
Okay.
No, Catholic. Yeah. Irish Catholic.
Irish Catholic. Yeah. Because when I was reading, you were a minister and your son Gable wasn't baptized and you figured, like, I'm a minister now. Maybe I could sneak off.
Yeah. Well, the thing was, I was raised Catholic. I don't practice anymore because I got it down, you know? And I'm learning other instruments now.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I thought, okay, my wife wasn't into organized religion, didn't want to raise him any specific religion.
Mm-hmm.
I said, okay, I'll teach him about Catholicism. He'll learn about all religions, you know, we'll learn about Baha'i and Judaism and all that. And then I figured, I said, well, at least get him baptized, right? He goes, no, that's hokey pokey.
Right.
I said, okay, I'll just bring him, get him baptized, you know, when she's not around. And, you know, he's a baby. He won't know. And I procrastinated too long. And then he started learning how to speak. So it was too late then.
Yeah.
To do it. Because he would tell mommy, some guy with a white collar would throw water on me. And
they made me eat this cookie.
Yeah. So, but I can do it as a minister in the open ministry. I think I can do that.
Yeah. I'm a surviving Catholic. My father wasn't religion, but he was a pragmatist. So he says, listen, you've been baptized, you made your first communion, you made your confirmation. All your paperwork's done. If you want to go to church, you can go with your mother on Sunday. I won't be there. So
yeah, that's right. My father would bring us to church and we'd always get there so late, just before communion.
Yeah.
And if you got there before communion, it counted as going.
You're in. Yeah. That's cool. Well, yeah, your dad, just to back up, your dad worked for a helicopter company. You were in Germany from the ages 6 to 10. And then you learned how to swim in Greece and you learned how to ski in Austria. Is that where Hans and Franz maybe originated in your head?
Well, you know, I think the names kind of came up with it. You know, Dana and I came up with those characters. We were on the road doing a stand-up tour and we were in Des Moines, Iowa, mm-hmm. at a Red Lion Inn. And Arnold Schwarzenegger was on a Showtime up close and personal interview.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's talking the way he does. And I called Dana. I said, Dan, you got to watch this. It's so funny, this accent, you know, the way he's talking and things like that. And, you know, so, you know, such an Austrian. And for the rest of the tour, we started talking like, and we thought, you know, before we start up next season on SNL, we should come up with some characters. And I think I came up with the names because I knew, you know, I mean, anybody came up with Hans of France, but, you know, it rhymed and they were from Austria.
Right.
And it worked out well. But, it's really funny how you come up with ideas for things. You know, if you think a lot of it, the best ones are organic.
Yeah.
You know, like my hiking show, I just hiked with a friend of mine, Mackie Modine. I say, hey, Matt, you want to go for a hike? He goes, sure. So we go to Temescal Canyon in the Palisades and we're hiking. And we're both so out of breath near the top of the mountain. I thought this would be a funny interview. If I was interviewing him, you couldn't understand me because I'm like, so when you came up to Hollywood and your agent, and he would answer me like that too. And that was funny. And then on the way back down the other side of the canyon, I asked him some more serious questions. I was just holding my camera. I said, hey, Matt, you ever turned down anything you regretted? And he rolled his eyes. He goes, oh man, after Full Metal Jacket, I was really picky. I turned down Big, the Tom Hanks role. I turned down Back to the Future, Michael J. Fox role, Charlie Sheen in Wall Street, and the Tom Cruise role in Top Gun.
Mm.
I said, you idiot. And he laughed. We both laughed. And I, you know, I just posted it on YouTube or on Instagram and Twitter. And then I started doing it. But that was all organic. You know, I didn't plan it.
Right.
It just happened.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
and those tend to be the best.
Even the way you got Saturday Night Live wasn't, you didn't plan it. I remember the story.
Right.
You got a call from Dana in the kitchen, in Lorne Michaels' kitchen.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I, you know, you know what it was like. You were in Hollywood. They would come through every once in a while and have a showcase. And you had to have a really high-powered agent, or, you know, you have to be in the groundlings where they could see you in an improv group. Otherwise, you'd never see the day of light with that show. Mm-hmm. And they came out to see Dane, and I was really excited for him. And then he got hired to go that summer for that coming fall. And I was so excited that I knew somebody that's going to be on SNL. You know, that was, and I never even thought about being on that show because I didn't do characters or accents, you know. I remember I used to watch it and I would always fall asleep in the original cast. And I wake up when they're doing the goodnights, where they're all waving goodnight, you know, so I would never see a lot of it. So Danny gets on the show. He goes to New York. And also Jan Hooks is up for a part on the show. And I was dating her at the time. And we had been friends for a long time. So I was excited for her too. And I started reading Backstage Live, you know, from the original years and SNL. And then I get a call from Dana out of the blue. He goes, Kev, it's Dana. I'm at a Lorne Michaels house in Amagansett. I'm in the back bedroom. Guess who's in the kitchen? Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd. I said, you're kidding me. He goes, no. He said, anyway, Lorne Michaels wants to, I told him about you, looking for one more cast member. I told him about you and he might want to see your audition tapes. I said, Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd are in the kitchen? I couldn't believe it. I wasn't even hearing the other stuff.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? Because I knew I'd never get on that show because I don't do characters or impressions or accents. I'm just a stand-up, mm-hmm. a really good stand-up.
Yes, you are.
But I sent my tape in anyway, audition tape. And 2 weeks later, I get another call from Dana. Kev, I'm back at a Lorne Michaels house. I'm in the back bedroom. Guess who's in the kitchen? Steve Martin. I said, no way. He goes, yeah. Anyway, Lorne likes your tapes. I think they're going to fly you in for an audition. I said, Steve Martin's really in the kitchen?
You still?
I wasn't hearing the other stuff. Because I, you know, you've been down that road so many times where you don't want to get your hopes up. And so I fly into New York. To me, I'm thinking it's just a free trip to New York. And I get to 30 Rockefeller Plaza where they tape the show. And I go up to the studio 8H. And as soon as I walked into the studio, I got really tired, you know, because I used to fall asleep watching that show. Mm-hmm. It was an association thing, you know.
Okay.
And I do my little audition and I fly home. And 2 weeks later, I find myself sitting in a high rise in Beverly Hills across from Lorne Michaels. And he's offering me a job on SNL. And I said, thank you, Mr. Michaels. Let me think about it over the weekend.
I don't think. And what did Lauren say?
Well, you know, I said that because he only offered me a job as a writer.
Oh, okay.
And it wasn't a lot of money. No, it was a feature player. Mm. He offered me a job as a feature player. And it wasn't enough money to really live in New York.
Right.
You know, I was guaranteed like 7 shows out of the 22. So my agent said, why don't you make him a writer too? My manager, who also, by the way, happened to manage Lorne Michaels.
Is it Brad?
Brad Gray, yeah. So Lauren said, well, you think about it over the weekend and we'll see you in New York on Monday. He saw right through me. So the next thing you know, I'm out at Amagansett at his house and I get a call from Dana Carvey. Hey, Kevin, back at Lorne Michaels' house. Guess who's in the kitchen? I said, I'm in the kitchen now. You never know who's going to be in that kitchen.
That's great. You know,
yeah, it was...
I always
because I showed up, Adam. You know what I mean? I showed up. I mean, I could have just said, no way. Yeah. I'll never get that.
Fuck. You know, I got, you think Matthew Modine kicks himself. I got a machine that kicks myself in the ass of the things that I didn't show up for. As I got older, I realized 90% is just fucking showing up, Kevin.
Showing up. Yeah. I mean, that's really part of the job as an actor is just showing up, doing the auditions, and mm-hmm. then just walking away. I usually just throw my script out in the garbage as I leave.
Yeah, I do the same thing because I don't want to hold on to it. I'm like, I've done my work.
Yeah,
I'm entitled to this work. I'm not entitled to the fruits of my labor. So this is my little thing, and I throw it away.
My first biggest letdown, maybe you know this, but I had 5 callbacks for a sitcom. I've been in Hollywood for like 2 years. I moved out here from Connecticut to be a stand-up. Mm-hmm. And I go in and I audition for this sitcom. And I get 5 callbacks. And the 2 producers look at each other and they go, we're not getting any closer than this. And I walk outside that office. I look at Paramount Studios. I go, this is my new home, baby. It's going to be nice, man. This business is not that hard. A week goes by, I don't hear anything. 2 weeks go by, I don't hear anything. Then I hear they're looking for actors that are older to play the part.
Yeah.
Because I was like 26 at the time. And it was for the part of Sam Malone in Cheers. Ted Danson got it.
Ah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, but, you were right there. Jim Burrows? Was Burrows in the
room? Yeah, Jim Burrows. Yeah, so here it is in full circle. So I do this TV show that started 4 years ago called Man with a Plan with Matt LeBlanc. It just got, it hasn't been renewed this year. So we had a 4-year run. It was good. And, but Jim Burrows was the director. So when he saw me, we both smiled and said, wow, it's been a while. It's been like 30 years, you know? And we kind of reminisced about that casting.
Yeah.
They wanted me to do a chemistry meeting with Matt LeBlanc. You know, that's what they call it now instead of an audition.
Yeah. It's like Coppola going, no, Mr. Brando, it's a lighting test.
Yeah. I had a dentist appointment that morning, and I thought, you know, I gotta keep this dental appointment. It's just a small filling they gotta put in. And I get there and it turned out to be a bigger deal. So they had to give me a lot of Novocaine, and I was running behind, and I finally left the office. I said, I really have to go. I have to go. Can you just wrap it up? I've never rushed the dentist before. And I'm driving over Laurel Canyon, learning my lines, and you know, I'm trying to hit my thing to get it unnumb, you know, and I get there. And there's a guy in the parking lot who's also waiting to go in. He's kind of, you know, pacing. He's got his script, and it's Tom Segura.
Oh yeah,
you know, he was reading for the part too, and so I go in, and Matt LeBlanc comes in, and I don't know him. I only knew him from Joey, his friends, you know. And he goes, "Hey, how you doing?" I say, "Hey, yeah, it's the line. I got it." He goes, "You want to run this a few times?" I say, "Sure." So I ran it a few times with him, but you know, my mouth was so like he must have thought I had a stroke or something. And he might have told the producers that. He went in afterwards. They said, "How is he?" He goes, "He's pretty good. His timing is good, but I think he might have had a stroke."
That's funny. Well, yeah. Can I ask you about the vacation you took in the castle?
Oh yeah, yeah. Where are you getting all your information?
I got a guy. I got a guy.
Did you read my book?
I got a guy.
You got a guy.
Italian's got a guy.
You got a guy.
Yeah. What do you think? Your brother's a private eye. You know, one call.
Yeah, that's right. you're referring to the castle in Scotland?
Yes.
Yeah, that was Billy and Pamela Connolly's castle in Scotland, in the Highlands. I'd never been to Scotland before. And
Billy Connolly's fucking funny.
Yeah, he's a funny guy. He's a funny guy. I mean, so unique. And I went to see him in concert the first time, and I couldn't understand a word he was saying until like halfway through when I started getting the cadence of his, you know, the I have the birthday. I know what he was saying. And but he was hilarious. And so he and his wife invited us and a bunch of other people like Eric Idle and Robin Williams. You know, Peter Asher, speaking of the Beatles.
Wow.
To this, apparently it's a thing they did yearly out of this beautiful castle that they owned in the Highlands outside of Aberdeen. And it was a week long event, and it was just amazing time. We did it twice, and every night was a different theme night. You know, they had jousting, you know, where, you know, they had the reenactments. We'd be out in the tent. Eating another night, it would be, you know, actually, you know, my wife and I got married in Italy, in Lake Como. And we were on our way to get married, and we stopped at one of those parties. And because she was a ship captain, like a minister, open ministry, right. She was able to marry us. So one night, the theme night, we come down to the dining room, the big long table, and there's rose petals all over it. And everybody had an assignment, we didn't know, to come up with a poem or a song about us getting married.
Oh, wow.
And then, so there's Dame Judi Dench, you know, giving us a toast and Rob and, you know, Billy and Eric Idle, you know, and it was just really magical time. And then we went off to Italy from there and got married.
Fuck, that's just, when you get to do shit like that, you ever pinch yourself like, you know, like.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean,
I'm from Bridgeport, Connecticut.
It's not wasted on me.
Yeah.
I know, Bridgeport. I worked in Sikorsky Aircraft in a helicopter factory for 2 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just, it's why I take up instruments, because if I could do stand-up and make money doing that, I could learn how to play an instrument.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, but it's also the willingness to put yourself through what you have to go through to create something. And I'm going somewhere with this because I can only imagine that you had to go through a bunch of pain to write the eulogy for Gary. I'm talking, of course, about Gary Shandling. First of all, the emotional balance of your speech, I was like, yeah, he fucking worked on this. You could see the time and the care that you put into that.
Yeah. Well, it had been a month since Gary had died.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you get through the initial blast of it. And then you start reflecting and you start, you know, thinking about your life together.
Yeah.
And all the memories that you had and what he meant to you and, you know, why he was so unique. And then you know, and it was painful going through it because you relived it all and knowing that he was no longer around. And so, yeah, I put a lot of work into that, a lot of thought. And
yeah.
Wrote it and I had to read it because I wouldn't be able to get through it if I was just talking, you know?
Yeah.
But it was funny because I didn't go up at that eulogy until, I don't know, almost near the end. And I was like crossing out stuff, you know, that people were talking yeah. about Gary, you know?
It's like a roast. It's like, I can't do that joke. They already hit that
yeah.
joke.
I can't do that one. Yeah. But it was very meaningful to me, and it was to be able to eulogize him and to get laughs and to, you know, share emotion with him was probably the highlight of my stand-up career.
Yeah.
You know, because it had so much meaning and depth to it, I think, you know, and people could really relate. We're all on the same page. You know, it wasn't like doing a comedy club.
Yeah, it's I know a lot of the comedy, you know, stuff that comes from my comedy. It's not that I don't want to face the pain. I want to make sense of it. If that makes any sense, it's like
yeah.
I want to just make sense of it, so I know what I'm. If I can make somebody laugh, I know the truth is in there somewhere, and then I can examine it, and it puts it outside of me. If that makes any sense. And I got a yeah. guy on the show, my friend Phil Tagg is another comic, and he's. You know, we've been together, we've just known each other for 30 years as comics. And one of the things I saw in our relationship, I saw in your and Gary's relationship, was a weird night. I saw you guys on stage at Comedy Magic Club. I had been down a week before.
Right.
And I ran into Gary there, and he was just getting his feet back. You know, he was away for a while. And I was in the green room when I finished my set. I was in the green room. And he went, man, that's your. He was so complimentary. He did that for other comics. He was so complimentary of what I did.
He was.
Yeah. And he said to me, he's like, you know, I got to get back on the horse. I got to. But he spoke to me. There was a comfort of being another comic that he could share that with me because, you know, I'm just getting back on the horse. And
yeah,
I
yeah.
remember seeing you guys there on stage together. And I went, they love each other. And I couldn't help but think you were there to help him, if that's accurate.
That is accurate. He felt really uncomfortable being on stage alone.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of wanted a slow handoff, you know, where
yeah.
I would bring him out and then I would stay there with him.
Mm-hmm.
It was almost like dropping a kid off at kindergarten. You know what I mean? And eventually I would kind of leave and he would be okay with it. But, you know, his career was really interesting as far as stand-up because near the end of his life, you know, his stand-up style kind of changed. You know, he took his delivery was sort of awkward. Mm-hmm. You know, he'd take these really long pauses and he would be bobbing and weaving because he was also learning how to box, you know. He'd go down to this gym. He loved boxing.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's on stage, he'd be doing his jokes and almost going through the boxing movements, you know. And then he'd take these really long, uncomfortable pauses. And then he would also get up at Largo with Judd Apatow, I think, and do stuff, you know. But he never really got that confidence back, I don't think, from his the height of his career. And yet, he was full of compliments for me. Kevin, you're at the top of your game. I've never seen you so good. You know, I've never, you know, always, like you said, complimentary.
Yeah.
And we played basketball at his house every Sunday with a bunch of different guys. Adam McKay would play. And I mean, I've seen everybody at those games play. You know, Sarah Silverman was a regular player. And guys like Jim Carrey would show up. Brad Pitt I saw there. Tom Petty was there watching once, smoking, chain smoking. and then afterwards, you know, we sit down in this little like family room with the TV. There'd always be a game on. Football game or something, and we'd all be sweating and people would just kind of pick his brain a little bit, you know. And he was like the guy. he was the guy that people would go to. I mean, Judd Apatow would be there, Adam McKay, and everybody was just kind of like knew that he was the guy, you know, that would have great advice for you.
Yeah.
If you were working on a project.
Yeah. Yeah. Because he started as a writer. So he had, you know, he had the scaffolding first. And I think, I don't know this to be true, but I think the performance part of it came later. And that was kind of maybe an emotional emollient to deal with whatever acceptance that we all seek from an audience.
Yeah, I think he, you know, I think he always wanted to be a stand-up, but I think the writing job came, you know, Sanford and Son and a couple other shows in LA, but I think he always wanted to do stand-up.
Yeah.
You know, he used to write jokes for George Carlin. Mm-hmm. He would send jokes to George Carlin.
I've heard of him.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. When I was first starting off doing stand-up comedy, there was a dinner club called The Horn in Santa Monica.
Right.
It was like the last remaining dinner club where, you know, the tables, the candles on them, and there'd be a singer and then a comic, a singer and a comic. And I would go down there and I would do a set, like an open mic night or something. And I remember finishing the set and then walking to the back, going past the bar, and there was a guy sitting at the bar with a Mets baseball cap on, the old fashioned Mets baseball cap. And I couldn't see his face, it was in the shadow. And he reaches up to me, he goes, "Hey man, that was really good. Stay with it." And it was George Carlin.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then I saw him at the Improv. You know, I worked as a bartender at the Improv for a couple of years. So I kind of pretty much lived at the Improv as a comic. Mm-hmm. And I would see everybody there, from Robin Williams to Andy Kaufman to, you know, I mean, and the people that came in there, Bob Fosse, you know, I mean, it's endless. There's so many people, but then I would see, George Carlin, you know, now that I'm bartending, I could go up into the office area where he was like getting ready to go on.
Yeah.
It's amazing how studious he was. He would write everything and he'd rehearse it in his head.
Yeah.
Maybe you saw him at the Comedy Magic Club too. He would be doing a bit, and if he messed up, he goes, "Okay, I'm going to back up and do that again." You know, because he's really actually rehearsing to do a special.
Yeah.
And so he's got this whole bit written out and he wanted to take it from the beginning again, you know?
Yeah. I opened for him at the Comedy and Magic Club.
Oh, you did. Okay. Yeah,
and you can't, you know, like you said, the green room is his, you can't go in afterwards. He couldn't be nicer to you. You know, you can take pictures, shake hands, the whole thing. So I walked, he was in there rehearsing. I walk off stage and the MC went up in between it. And there's this little guy, silver beard, these two little eyes. Standing by the entrance, and he went, "You're funny," and I went, "And you're Carlin," and we just started bullshitting, and he missed his fucking intro. They started because we're backstage talking. We're just you know, Kibitz. He watched the half of my set. He quoted back a joke. He said how funny that was, and he missed. They start clapping. He looks at me, goes, "Is that for me?" I'm like, "They don't want to see me again, George. You better get out there." And he ran out.
But I was surprised at how nervous he was. You know, he was just really. And that's something that I kind of lost. You know, do you get nervous before you go on?
I get nervous here's when I get nervous. If I have to run a set for the Tonight Show, if I have an agenda on stage, I get nervous. If I'm not free to go up, but I get excited. I've changed my the way I label that energy to excitement now.
Okay.
So, but that energy is still there. But, you know, I get angry about having to go back on the road when we were free to travel. But
for me, I kind of feel dead inside. I mean, I don't get nervous. All right? At least I don't think I get nervous. Somebody said, "You ever get stage fright?" And I said, "No, I don't." But I will tell you that maybe 60% of the times before I go on stage, I get really tired.
Okay.
You know, and that might be my body preparing, like to go into battle. It's just totally shutting down. You know what I mean? And I'm just kind of reserving all my energy. And I think that might be my stage fright right there.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this. First time you do the Tonight Show with Johnny, by the way, big event in your life. He gives you a great intro. You go on stage. They introduce you, walk out, applause dies down, and you fucking go blank. Were you nervous then?
Oh yeah. I would never been more nervous in my life. Cause that's what I want. That was my goal. Mm-hmm. You know, all I wanted to be was a stand-up and be on the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. And when I first moved out to LA, I would go and watch that show be taped, you know, a couple times a week because they gave out free tickets.
Right.
They gave two tickets to everybody. And I knew that people didn't always use their extra tickets. So I'd go up and down the line. Does anyone have an extra ticket? You know, I wouldn't get there, you know, like at 2 p.m. to get a ticket. I would go right before the show started. And I usually get in, and it was like watching a Vegas show. You know, you'd see all these different performers, and I saw the routine, I saw the format of the show, how Johnny would come out and, you know, warm up the audience, and that Freddie DeCorvo, the producer, mm-hmm. and talk to Doc Severinsen. I knew all the band members, what they played. And so now I'm standing behind the curtain, and I'm a stand-up on the show, and I'm making my debut, and he's introducing me. And Jim McCauley, who was the talent coordinator, is standing by me trying to pump me up, and you know, everything's cool, and the curtain opens, and I'm walking out, and there's Johnny to my right, and the audience is applauding, and mind you, like I was alerted that I was doing the show like four days before, like on that Friday, mm-hmm. and then on that Tuesday I was going to do it. So I've been continuously going over my act in my head. Because back then, you know, they didn't have bullet points alongside the camera, what they have now for comics.
Nope.
And you didn't have any notes or anything. You just had it in your head. And so I go out there and the audience is applauding and I hit my mark and I totally forgot my act. I forgot my opening act, my opening line. And the audience is applauding until it finally ends, the last clap. And thankfully, I remembered my act. And I started going into it, and it was just like the highlight to this day, more so than Weeds, mm. Saturday Night Live. It was just a ride that I've never experienced before. And it was, you know, the applause breaks and the people laughing. I hear Johnny laughing behind me. I thought, this is it. This is what is better than this.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I go to Lee. I finish up. I wave. Johnny gives me the thing. And I go behind the curtain, and Jim McCauley, he said, hang out. That was great. Hang out, because I think Johnny wants to talk to you on panel after the commercial. And I said, what can he ask you? Mm-hmm. He said, don't worry, just go out there. You'll be fine. So I got there and it was fine. And you know, he brings me back out, and I had a couple of really strong jokes that I didn't use. Mm-hmm. I used those, and it was just, and he would laugh. He'd lean back and laugh, and cigarette smoke was coming out of his mouth from, you know, during the break, he had a puff on his cigarette. And it was really, I mean, I was floating after that.
Yeah.
And I knew that, you know, at the improv later that night, everybody would be quiet and they'd be watching that little TV over the bar.
Yeah.
Where I used to bartend. And it was just, I've never had such a natural high like that before.
Yeah. I got, early on, those buzzes for me, they would last a day. You know, I could ride that buzz for a day.
Oh yeah, at least. I mean, I'm still writing mine.
So you identify yourself as a stand-up. That was your first love, and
that's right. Yeah, stand-up is what I wanted.
Now I wanted to ask you this because there's a connective tissue of a bit from your act that became a Saturday Night Live sketch, and I wanted the subliminal guy.
Yeah,
because I remember that was a bit in your act.
Yeah,
and then it became a sketch. But I wanted to ask you: did you read the book Vance Packard, The Hidden Persuaders, about subliminal advertising?
I did.
I read
all those books.
Because I read that book, I went, I bet you, fuck. Every time I see, I forget to ask you. I go, he read that fucking book.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. And then I started looking for subliminal suggestions in all products. You know.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like those little things that just might suggest, like, you know, if you look at a cloud, sometime you can see an image. You know, if that was an ad, you go, oh, they're trying to sell me a can of Coke or something. You know. Yeah.
You've done so many.
It's like signs, you know, like, it's like my wife believes in signs, you know, if a ladybug is good luck, or if somebody dies, you know, they like gold paper clips. Oh, there's a gold paper clip. That's a sign from them. You know, I don't think it works, but it did on SNL. So that's all that matters.
Yeah. I don't think my wife, you hear the crickets? That means money's coming. And I'm like, sing, you fucking bugs. Sing.
But I remember right before I did that sketch, that was the first sketch I did on there. This mm-hmm. is subliminal. And I'm really nervous, you know, and I can't believe I'm on SNL. You know, I'm about to do this sketch. And Lorne Michaels, the producer, comes up to me. It's 5 seconds before we're back from commercial. Mm-hmm. He puts his hand on my shoulder and he goes, are you sure this is what you want?
That's great. Yeah. Now, did you write that sketch with Albert Brooks?
No. I wrote that, like you said, that was in my act. Mm-hmm. That was part of my act. It was a bit, Did you do a bit that I got from this character actor who's a really good friend of mine, Ed Peck. Mm-hmm. Ed Peck had a really deep voice. He talked like this. And he was a character actor. He did a lot of Laverne and Shirley's and Happy Days. Mm-hmm. And he took me to Canner's one night. And he goes, I'm going to do a little thing called tagging. And this will be a lot of fun. Watch what I do. And the waitress comes over. And she goes, hi, honey, can I help you? What can I get you? Well, I'm going to have a cheeseburger. I'm going to have a cheeseburger, whore. And I'll tell you what, why don't you also give me a side of fries with that? He do a lot of like vulgarity, in there, and she wouldn't hear it, Whoa. So he said, you should do that in your act, take it, use it in your act. Mm-hmm. And I did. And I started expanding on it,
Right.
And then when I got to SNL, Al Franken knew about subliminal advertising. Mm-hmm. So he said, we should make this a guy who says these things to get what he wants.
Right.
So we sat down and wrote, the guy who goes to his boss to try to get Mets tickets. Mm-hmm. And that was it. That was the, that's how that one came about. When you go into a situation like that, I was used to writing jokes. So now I got to come up with characters, mm-hmm. I got to come up with accents and characters and sketch ideas. And I really enjoyed that. It was a really nice turn. Talk about learning new things. That was another thing I had to learn.
Yeah.
You just kind of have to adapt to whatever situation you're in.
Yeah, I also know, because I know a couple of guys that were on it after you, and the competitive nature of it, I don't know if it devolved, but it didn't seem like a place where you could relax. it didn't seem like a place where you
could. You could relax. In fact, that's one of the reasons I left, is I was too relaxed. I was going out and doing sketches with food in my mouth from the craft service table. That's how I was kind of bored after a while.
I'm the red vine guy.
Yeah. I would be doing a scene. I'd be picking food out of my teeth, with the other actor. And then I could hear all my friends in my dressing room. I could hear the blender in my dressing room from the stage. They're making mudslides and watching a different show, And I couldn't even get in there to change. So I thought maybe I've had my run here, Yeah. But it was kind of competitive, but it was a quiet competitiveness, mm-hmm. Because there was only so many slices of the pie,
right?
Only so many sketches that would get on. Mm-hmm. And it was like 10 sketches and, you had a table read full of like 40 or 50 sketches that people wrote. Yeah. And so it's hard to kind of root for somebody else when you put so much time into your sketch and you want it to get on, know? Although I did root for other people, I if something was funny, I laughed and I enjoyed it.
Well, you did what? 8 years?
9 years.
9 years. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you've had a great career, my friend. I'm always happy to see you when I do see you. Like I said, when I saw your paintings, I went, oh, I got to text them. These are fucking great. Please go on Kevin's Instagram and look at his art.
I have my regular Instagram is Kevin Nealon. Mm-hmm. And then all my artwork is on Kevin Nealon Artwork on Instagram.
Cool. Best to you and the family. Thanks, Adam. The Adam Ferrara podcast is brought to you by cruiseintowellness.com. Now, let's say you have stress.
Like you?
Yes. Let's say you have anxiety.
Like you?
Yes. You know what you should do? You should do what I do.
Scream and yell and drive your wife insane?
What?
Exactly.
Go to cruiseintowellness.com. They have edibles, tinctures, pain creams, bath products, pet products. Yes, young lady.
And the bath bubble thing.
And the bath bubble thing when your husband screams and yells and drives you insane. Mm-hmm. 20% off with the coupon code Adam. Cruiseintowellness.com. Go. Feel better.
Hi, this is Kevin Nealon, and that's 30 minutes you'll never get back.
Oh, he's such a good guy, Kevin. I really had a lot of fun.
I was impressed with how, because I love his stand-up, obviously, and SNL and all that, but I'm amazed at how, and impressed at how versatile the guy is with the painting and instruments and the book and all that stuff. I thought that was really cool.
And you know what? The thing I took, and there's so much cool stuff in there, but the origin story of Hans and Franz just grabbed me. Because I love, it's like hearing about how somebody wrote a song. And here he is, he's on tour with Dana Carvey, watching Schwarzenegger in some special, just laughing at how he talks. And that becomes, one of the great bits of Saturday Night Live lore. I mean, everyone here, show of hands, who went as Hans and Franz at Halloween ever? Yes, my hand is up, because I love that bit.
Yeah, because everybody had the sweats. I'll just stuff some stuff in here, put this belt on. I'm done.
Yeah.
Shout out to the easy costume.
Yeah. And the other thing about Hans, I asked him, I'm like, do you think it came out of your childhood in Austria?
He's like, yeah. No, it's on the TV, man.
He's like, nah, I made Dana laugh. Oh, all right, fine. But yeah, if you look at that iconic stuff, and Mr. Subliminal was a bit in his act that turned into that bit.
Yeah.
The evolution of stuff.
So what was Mr. Subliminal? I kind of missed that whole era thing.
So yes, yeah, so honey, the subliminal bit was like he'll be talking in a conversation and then whisper something, the subtext of what he's really thinking. He's like, you know, Mark Stern lives with two cats and he pays no attention to his teeth.
That joke and that bit is all about delivery. It's all about the timing and the delivery. And he just nailed it. That was, again, when I think of some of the great sketches, and I love that year of Saturday Night Live, Kevin Nealon is involved in so many of those. And it blew me away that he's like, I'm not a sketch guy. I don't do impersonations. And from the outside, I'm like, yeah, you did. You were great. That's what I think of him as, you know?
Mm. He's just naturally funny. Some people just have that. They could do anything. Even like in Weeds, I laugh when he comes on screen. I just giggle because he's just funny.
You know what? I love this, the selflessness of his friendship with Dana, because he was so happy that he was getting Saturday Night Live that he was calling him in the kitchen. And he was like, dude, guess who's here? They want to see your tape. Wait a minute. Steve Martin's there?
Right. Yeah, I love that. I love the romance of that. It's great.
Yeah, it was just like, he's like, no, they might want to hire you on the show. Chevy Chase is there.
Yeah. Oh, my God. You're talking to Bill Murray?
Yeah.
You know why that's so cool? Because I like to think that's exactly how I would react. I'd be like, oh, my God, Bill Murray and Steve Partner there. That's just the coolest.
Yeah.
You know, that. I mean, he's a big star, but, you know, everybody starts out as a fan, man. And that's just, I don't know. It was a real moment. It was really cool.
Yeah, it was.
What you and Kevin talked about when he was talking about writing the eulogy for Gary, and you talked about how you process pain, you process pain on stage, and when you get that laugh, it kind of centers it. You can find the truth from that. I just thought that was a really fascinating process for both of you guys to work through these incredibly painful things that have gone on in your lives.
Yeah, I think, and the process is just taking little bites of what it is and turning that into a laugh. So, okay, it's safe for me to take the next bite.
Okay.
And I can't do it alone. I need the audience as the reassurance. So it's always working with I feel more comfortable in a group of people rather than in my own head.
Adam, let me ask you, I always wanted to ask you this.
Mm-hmm.
Processing your pain when you're on stage, is it because there's this, because I know when I'm sad, I laugh because I feel uncomfortable or nervous,
right?
Just unsure.
Yeah, I know Phil, you have this too. You want to be the emollient for the moment. Any tension, we're conditioned to be the comic relief.
Mm-hmm.
To which is so important. The tension. Yeah, it's also a way of avoiding your true feelings.
Well, there's that.
Yeah,
I do that too. Or I just, you know, buy a car. That's what I do. You know what I mean? Is that a convertible? What's he avoiding now?
Yeah.
What is he avoiding now?
Hey, sometimes you just gotta, you know, buy your pain away.
Yeah,
yeah. For 23 grand, then lose 7.
Yeah.
We gotta listen to Adam, right, Adam?
Well, no, it fills in a lot of pain now because he bought a Lexus, so something. Something's weighing heavy on your mind.
I did. I bought the car that you told me to buy originally.
Yeah. He bought the car I told you to buy 2 cars ago.
Yeah.
You know what, Phil? I don't care. I'm glad you didn't get married. If it's a choice between the two of them.
Yeah.
Adam can't take it.
I can't take it. I'm not going through another divorce. I can't take it.
But I'm losing more money now with the cars. I might as well get married.
But yeah, and I think Kevin, like when Kevin worked on Gary's eulogy, you know, that's how he was processing the pain, was he was putting it through his art. He was putting it through his machine. Mm-hmm. And it meant a lot to him. And that's hard to do because you're still in the shock of it.
Yeah.
Well, I had that with my dad. I mean, when I wrote my dad's eulogy, the same thing. We made it funny, you and I. That was one of the greatest, I guess, you know, my dad had passed away, but you and I working on that eulogy and then getting the laughs, you know, talking about my dad in church. I mean, I was very impressed by that when I saw, I think that was Judd Apatow's documentary where they showed Neilan doing that eulogy, and I was just blown away by it. It was, and I had no idea they were that close.
Yeah.
And what I loved a lot, I loved, you know, just to, you know, hop on the sincere train for a second. I really love what you said when you told Kevin that it reminded you of you and I, his relationship with Gary when you were at the Comedy Magic Club. And so I thought that was really cool.
Well, yeah. And I was actually, I'll be honest with you, Paul, I was thinking about, you know, having to do that in that emotional state and to do what we know in the face of that kind of pain. That's why I took the liberty, because I don't know if I really want to experience that. So I took the liberty of writing your eulogy now.
Oh, my God. Oh, Jesus.
Seems entirely appropriate.
I was going to say, if you don't want to go through it, you could die first. You could do that. God.
Come on. You know you're going to go first. Look at you. All right. Let's all focus. This is a serious moment.
Whatever.
We are all gathered here today to say farewell to a great man. And I want to thank you both for coming.
Two people. Nice.
Here lies Phil Tiberius Tagliaferri.
I don't even have a middle name.
You do now. Devoted father, beloved husband, a couple of times.
Oh my God.
And my best friend. Phil was a kind and generous soul. I could always count on him to listen to my cries of pain with a sympathetic ear. Some say his ears were that big so he could hear all of God's children.
Nice. That's nice.
But we're not here to point out his big ears, failing heart,
fuck!
Or beady eyes. If Phil taught us anything, it was that we have the power of choice, which is why I choose to remember Phil as my best friend. And not as that mass of flesh found naked on the bathroom floor.
That's how I go out.
Covered in butterscotch crimped icing.
Oh, no.
I go out like that, naked.
With butterscotch.
Godspeed, Phil. And please know, I emptied your drawer.
True friendship.
Let us pray.
Lovely.
What is wrong with you, man? How much friggin' time do you have on your hands? When did you write that? I'm writing my eulogy. That's a bad omen. What are you doing?
It's not a bad omen. It's not a bad omen. Phil, I did it more for me than for you. I don't want to go through that. I'm going to be in enough pain when you die.
Oh, my God.
It's about him, Bill.
So now my eulogy for you would be, he's not really dead. He's just messing with me. He's not dead. Trust me. I'm telling you, he's not dead. What's wrong with that man? Why is he yelling?
He's yelling.
There's no eulogy. He's alive. He's going to come popping up. He's Andy Kaufman.
There's going to be a church full of people going. Someone, Alex, go get him. Go get him, Alex. Oh, that's funny. I love you, Phil. Mm-hmm.
Go fuck yourself.
I want to thank Kevin Neilan for being my guest. I want to thank you guys for being here with us. And I want to thank you guys so much for all the love and support, not only for the album, but for the show. The show is growing, and it's all because of you. Honey, if they want to get a hold of us, where can they go?
TheAdamFerrara@gmail.com.
And show us how you're listening to the show. If you're listening on Apple or Spotify, take a screenshot, put it up on Instagram, tag us, and we will repost. And if you get a chance to leave us a review, it does help us with our friend,
Mr. Algorithm.
Please remember, life is hard. Take it easy on yourself. Pod is ended. Go in peace.
You just got this, you know, one tooth that's got a root canal thing, and we'll take care of that.
Mm-hmm. The Adam, if you think about it, that's pretty good odds.
Yeah, but the guy he said the dentist he went to is probably, what is he, blind?
Hey, that's my ear.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well.
I absolutely love this because, you know, if you own a home, it can be really hard to maintain. It's hard to find people that can help you for a big project or a small. Well, whether it's in everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality, it can be hard just to know where to start. But now all you need to do is Angie that. And find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need.
Angi has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angi app, answer a few questions, and Angi can handle the rest from start to finish. Or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angi that. Download the free Angi mobile app today or visit Angi.com. That's A-N-G-I.com.